Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 6th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Tikkun Olam, Making the World a Better Place for Women, presented by Carla Suomala. Disc number SUK 2005-05.
Carla Suomala. I teach at Luther College in the Religion and Philosophy Department. I teach Bible, specifically Hebrew Bible, as well as Judaism, and a whole bunch of other things as they come along. But those would be my areas. This week we've been looking at the whole idea of tikkun olam, just as I've been mentioning, with that definition of to mend or repair, to perfect, to transform the world. And we've looked at it in a number of different ways. And today we're going to take a look at tikkun olam as it deals with women in society. Yesterday we took a look at environmental issues and found that there are a lot of really, really interesting things that emerge from the classical text that can inform the environmental crisis and concerns that we have today. I just want to start out with a quote and to kind of get us started in thinking about these issues. "The world cannot be without sons and daughters," said Rabbi Judah the prince. "Yet happy is he who has sons, and woe to him who has daughters." Yeah, kind of an interesting thing. This ancient tradition, we'd like to think Rabbi Judah the prince wrote in the 3rd century, so a long time ago, but unfortunately things have not changed as much as one might hope. If you take a look at statistics today, nearly 92% of American Jewish couples say they want their firstborn to be a boy. 92%. When Jewish feminists look at this, they see some big problems. Big problems. To them, they say this is a symptom of a world in need of repair. 92%. I'm curious, I don't know that the numbers are all that different when you take a look at the population as a whole. I'm assuming slightly less, but if you take a look at Muslim families, I think the numbers would be right there as well, as well as other traditions. If you just do the cross-section of Americans, you'd have a very high number who would prefer their first child to be a boy. And sometimes I don't even think they have a specifically religious reason for doing it. Is this something that you think is true? What are your reactions to that?
This is what I thought, and I have no reason why I thought that.
And you thought you're
pregnant for the first time, I said, I hope it's a boy. I don't know why I said that.
It was a girl.
It was a girl.
Well,
that was fun.
It carries on the name, for one thing, which we're really hooked into.
All right. So carrying on the name might be one reason?
Yeah.
I think a lot of it years ago had to do with agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They wanted help in the fields. Yeah.
So you, to have a boy, to make sure you have one boy to do that.
Yeah.
Right. Other reasons why people today,
Misogyny. A lot of us don't realize how deeply seated it is in all of creation. Women have just known that it affects them deeply. So even out of a subconscious nurturing care to want their daughters to be safe, and even maybe not them, want them to come into being.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like you were saying, you don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know why. And
as a female, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. I wanted a boy first because if I had girls, I wanted them to have an older brother. Mm-hmm. I didn't have an older brother, I was the oldest.
But what would be the benefit to an older brother?
Someone to watch over. Yeah.
Take care. Yeah. Well, I was a big sister, and I'd say I did a pretty good job. You know, kind of an interesting. Yeah, but in some ways,
I did too. I had 2 younger brothers, and I
yeah, but there's that sense that it would be a different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of Fiddler on the Roof and Tavia feeling he had all these daughters and he had to provide dowries. So maybe there was a time when if you had daughters, you had to do with providing and didn't get the benefits from the marriage.
Possibly, yeah, that's a part of it. Uh-huh.
We come at this from a slightly different angle. We have a son and then 2 daughters. Our oldest and our youngest kid are adopted.
Uh-huh.
And We wanted a kid who didn't care, girl or boy. Easier to get a boy, because, and we asked the social worker why that was. Our adopted kids are from Korea. She said that a lot of people have a harder time adopting a son because of some of the stuff that's put on sons to carry on the family name. The genetic connection is maybe more important. Your daughters are not going to keep their name anyway. That's a mistaken assumption nowadays. I mean, I did, but I kept my name. But that girls are, maybe it's the sense of being more outsiders or something, but that more people want to adopt girls, and there's also the perception that girls are easier to rear. My mother thought that was hilarious. Which I sort of took exception to, but that in in the world of adoption, people are more inclined to adopt a girl than a boy.
You know, and that's kind of changing in some instances with adoption from China. Yeah. Is one of the biggest sources now of American adoption, and it is almost impossible to get a boy with the one child rule.
Right.
Only so it's kind of like interesting, so that girls, you know, you can't even get a boy. They won't send their boys out of China.
Unless they're disabled in some way.
Yeah.
But there's also a whole generation upcoming now of young men, only children, who can't find a bride.
It's a huge thing in India too. Of population imbalance. With the, I've done some reading, and with the ability to determine the sex of a child before birth, with a lot of the different sorts of things, women are having tests to determine whether that child will be a boy or a girl, and they will abort if it's a girl. So you have a huge, huge population imbalance occurring right now in India. And so we'll see, you know, it's going to be a huge problem at certain times. But you take a look around the world, and Judaism isn't any different, perhaps. And some of these things, as many of you mentioned, are really deep-seated. Sometimes we don't even know why we have these preferences. But as Jewish feminists have been pointing out, with the rise of the feminist movement, especially since the 60s, this is a problem. When there's that marked preference in general. Jewish feminism emerged at the, you know, it's part of a cultural movement. As Nellie Van Doren-Harder was pointing out, a lot of things that impact us are not just religious or just secular. They come together as part of our larger culture. And so Christian feminists, Jewish feminists, they kind of emerged within the movement of the larger feminist concerns. And it's hard to tell who started those. Was it a religious push, or were there other forces creating feminism? And it's kind of hard to dissect, but it's probably something mutual in there. So we have this long standing, and we talk about feminism emerging in the 60s, but that didn't mean that there was no women's movement before that. It goes back a long time in the United States, the 1800s, when you take a look at the movement for suffrage and women's rights and all that sort of thing. So kind of a long history in that way. Today, what I would like to take a look at is women specifically in Judaism. Since feminism has a lot of parallels across the culture, whether Jewish women, Christian women, any other women in society, I want to take a look at the things that Jewish feminists specifically have had to deal with and are contending with and trying to figure out, things that are in some ways unique to their tradition. There are certainly a lot of things that all women in our culture share, women and men, but there are some unique aspects of Judaism emerging from texts, traditions, and practices. All right. The one thing that I'd like to look at today, especially for the first part, is the whole issue of women and law within Judaism. This goes back a long way. If we take a look at, and I'm going to divide this into two different categories, women in the public or religious sphere, because those two, that's where the law would be regulating them. There were other laws, depending on the society in which they lived, that would have regulated women in still other ways. And then women in the private or domestic sphere. All right. And what kinds of laws regulated the activities and status of women? If you take a look at women in the public or religious sphere. They are exempted to from a number of sorts of laws and practices, and they are obligated to others. One of the first things that they're exempted from, sometimes prohibited, is study. All right? Exempted from study. Exempted means in some ways that they aren't obligated to do that, but in some Jewish communities, the practice was that women would not be permitted an education. Sometimes learning how to read, but beyond that, not an awful lot. And certainly not permitted to study the holy texts, the legal texts, the ones that shape the heartbeat of Jewish communities.
What was the obligation on men? How much study of what? For how long?
It depended on the community, but there's a saying that says that men start studying the Torah at age 3. Mm-hmm. They start studying the Mishnah at age 8, and then the Talmud, the queen of all texts, at age 16. Not everybody made it to the study of the Talmud or made it as far, but it did seem to be an obligation that men would learn Torah. And Torah has a couple meanings in Judaism. The strictest meaning is the first 5 books of the Old Testament, all right? Sometimes also called the Pentateuch. That is probably the most accurate definition. It has come to mean the biblical text, but when they say Torah, they mean the first 5 books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, because that's where the main body of legal material is held. So it looks as if men would start learning Torah very early on. I had a Hebrew teacher at Hebrew Union College who is a Jew who grew up in Turkey, and he says he remembers that at age 3, his parents had to pull him out from under the bed when the rabbi came to teach him Torah. and get him ready to go. And learning Torah is not, and studying is not perhaps the same word that you have in mind. This is memory. Often they're memorizing these texts, start to finish. So I did have a number of these old school professors who did have it memorized. They were raised in what they call the yeshiva tradition. Yeshiva is a Hebrew word for yeshav is to sit, but this is where the boys sit and learn. And where you have a repeater, somebody who repeats in front of the class, and the boys respond until the texts in their entirety are memorized. All right, that's pretty pretty interesting world in which people come from. So you'd start with that Torah, then you'd move on to Mishnah, which is a compilation of laws, all right, and then the queen text, the one with all of the argumentation and the most difficult in the Jewish tradition of Talmud. Right? So, and like I said, I would say most people had a good basis in Torah, generally something in Mishnah, and then much far fewer would start on the study of Talmud.
Did they memorize Mishnah also?
Yes, and Talmud. The ones that went that far. Really, it was remarkable. And my experience with this is with a professor in graduate school who was blind. He was originally from Lithuania, came to the United States during the World War II to escape persecution. He was not blind his entire life, but later in life he became blind. And I took a class from him in Talmud. And in a Talmud class, you always have a couple of books open at the same time. You've got, in terms of flipping through things. So we had our Torahs, our biblical text in front of us, and also the tractate or the section of Talmud we were looking at. And we'd go back and forth, and that sort of thing. And he would say, okay, Carla, read from Shemot, that's the Hebrew word for Exodus, or the word, what they call Exodus. And he'd say, the verse that says this, 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 and this. He was doing it from memory. So you'd try to flip it over and there was that Exodus 3, is that the middle of 3? You're trying to find that, and you get to it, you read it in Hebrew, and then he would say, Carla, I told you never to bring in that version. And you got to read the notes on the side. So he knew from memory, he had it in his head. And he did the same thing with Talmud. He said, now go back to your page and read from where it says. And he would do it. And I kept thinking, this man can't possibly be blind, but he had no books in front of him. And sometimes he wrote on the wall when he was looking for the board, so clearly. Yeah, but it's a tradition of memory. A tradition of memory where these texts truly become part of your fiber. That is not the case for women, however. It doesn't mean that women didn't have texts in memory, but it wasn't an emphasis, and women would have had smaller bits and pieces.
Carla?
Yes?
Up here.
Okay.
The girls who go to the yeshivas, you know, the parochial schools,
uh-huh.
Do they start memorizing in school then?
Today it's a different world because there's, even within very traditional Jewish communities, there will be some memorization, but certainly not to the extent.
Not like the boys.
And in parts of New York and in Israel, you will find yeshivas for girls where they do engage in Talmud study.
Equivalent.
And you can see, yeah, but it's not to the same extent. Because those young women will be expected to be married in a fairly short amount of time and having children, and at pretty much at that point their mm-hmm. Talmud study is limited.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, a question, Beth?
I just wanted to say, it's kind of a side, that you're talking through a Jewish lens. My first seminary was Dallas Theological Seminary in Dallas, Texas.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't the emphasis on memorization. But we studied the Bible much like the Jewish tradition.
Really?
And a lot of the people that had come from like the Navigator tradition, I don't know if you're familiar mm-hmm. with them, but they had whole sections of the Bible memorized. So it's not just the Jewish world that does this. And you wonder, people like George W. Bush and people in the evangelical world, where they're gaining a lot of their insight into how to do foreign policy. It's from their memorization and their knowledge of the Hebrew text.
In some ways, the key difference would be that Jews always did it in Hebrew. Christians have tended to use the translation of the language that they speak, and Jews have had a huge attachment to the Hebrew language even when they were not speaking it on a daily basis, but they would memorize it in the Hebrew and the linguistic issues that would emerge in text. They were very much more familiar with, I would say, in general, far more familiar with than their Christian counterparts.
At Dallas, people were required to take 4 years of Hebrew, mm-hmm. so it was almost as much.
Not quite. If you're doing it, think about it. 3 years old, you're doing this. You've got 15 years of Hebrew, 8 hours a day, by the time you'd even start advanced study. So I'm not contending that, because I'm out of that same tradition with that many years of Hebrew, but I've been up against those 15-year people, and my Hebrew doesn't hold a candle. And I've done, you know, so that in some ways, but, and I'm not doubting the Hebrew abilities. These people are fantastic, and they are dedicated, and they know their biblical texts. I'm just saying it's sort of a different tradition in some ways. But yeah, that memory of text, memorizing text, has played different roles in different communities. It is a huge thing in the Islamic community as well. One of the entrance requirements, and I don't know if it's still in place, to get into the University of Cairo was to have the entire Quran memorized. And that would be, you know, it's like, and we complain about our college entrance essays. So kind of interesting. Let's take a look at some of these other sorts of things. Obligated to perform the negative commands only. This is part of what women did say, and that meant thou shalt not command. So thou shalt not murder sorts of things. Women were obliged to fulfill those sorts of commands. Thou shalt not whatever it is. Those were the ones that women were required to do. They were exempted from positive time-bound commands. You shall do this at such and such a time, which a lot of times is worship and prayer issues, all right? Because the rabbis were concerned that anything that would interfere in the domestic realm and their domestic duties should not be part of a woman's position, all right? And there are three positive commands that women were required to do. These are the exceptions. Lighting the Sabbath candles, which happens at a very particular time, at dusk, on the Sabbath, which would be Friday afternoon. You can go online and you can find the Sabbath calendar for your area, and it'll say, you know, St. Paul, Minnesota, August, whatever, Sabbath begins at. All right, so people are very sensitive to that. The challah dough. A challah is a bread that's used for Sabbath as well as holiday meals. All right, and in that challah dough, that women were responsible for preparing that and having it ready by the time the festival or the meal started. Ritual immersion, all right, was the third obligation that women, time-bound obligation that women were required to fulfill. And this happened on two occasions. This happened after the monthly cycle, and they would be required to go as soon as that was complete, as well as after childbirth, all right? Those are the times that women were required to do their ritual immersion. The bath that they take is called the mikveh, all right? Women cannot, or could not be part of a minyan, and I've tried to eliminate the Hebrew words, but minyan is simply a group of 10 men who are required to do a full Torah service and prayer, all right? So let's say you have 10 people there and 3 are women, you can't hold your minyan, and you can do some prayers but not others, all right? So in New York City, for example, where there are neighborhoods where there are a lot of synagogues, sometimes in the morning, because this will often be what has happened, you'll see somebody out on the street and say, we need 2 more for a minyan. We need 2 more for a minyan. And people, and whether an Orthodox synagogue, people know what that means. Sometimes they'll just pop in, and it's, you know, and they don't check your credentials. As long as you're male, it's all right. All right? Traditionally, men and women were seated separately and segregated within the synagogue. All right? They were divided by something called a mechitza, a dividing wall or a curtain. And usually the way it would work, let's say this is a synagogue, the women would be up in that balcony up there, and probably not on the sides, because if you're sitting right here, a man could still see the women up there, could be possibly distracted, all right? And so there's gotta be some way that there's a separation, because women shouldn't be able to, their presence, their voices and their appearance should not distract men from prayer and Torah study, all right? So, and it doesn't always mean it's a balcony, but a lot of synagogues do have a balcony. Sometimes if it's a longer room, it'll simply be a curtain or a divider in the back, all right? Women not only have separate seating, but synagogue attendance is not required of women, since it is a time-bound sort of thing. All right, if they can come and they want to, great, they can go up there and do that. If not, that's all right too. So you have some women, Jewish women in history, who would never have gone. They didn't really bother, it wasn't part of their tradition, all right? In the synagogue, you have no public Torah reading, reading from the scriptures, all right? That would have created a number of problems. First of all, it would have required a woman getting in front of an audience or grouping of men or a mixed audience, and having a public role, and that was would also interfere with worship. No ordination of women into rabbinical roles, all right? So no female rabbis, no circumcision, and I don't know that this is such a bad thing, I don't know that we should advocate female circumcision, but what it means, the circumcision, is that there's only an entry right for men into the Jewish community. Circumcision is the mark of a Jew. It signifies your identity and your membership, your citizenship in the Jewish community. Women have no parallel sort of marking or entrance ritual, at least traditionally. All right. Further, and I don't have it on that list, but it should probably be there, is no bar mitzvah was traditionally permitted to women. Bar mitzvah simply means, bar is the Aramaic word, son of the commandment, meaning you sort of like confirmation in the Christian tradition where you take on the full obligations of an adult Jew in community. And since women can't do that, they're exempted from positive, or they only have to do, you know, some commandments, not others, they can't have that status as full member of the Jewish community. All right. So although some of these things have changed, and we will talk about that. All right. Women in the private and domestic sphere also had some issues to contend with that feminists have been examining in recent years. Divorce. We take a look at Deuteronomy 24. Moses outlined the first divorce law, and basically it can only be initiated by men. Men would write out what they call in Hebrew a get, all right, permitting the divorce. A woman, regardless of her situation, it doesn't matter if there was battery, abuse, anything, even infidelity on the part of her husband, that's not really even talked about, could not initiate a divorce. All right. So a woman, sometimes a woman could persuade her husband to give it to her, but if that wasn't possible, then she couldn't get a divorce. All right. In marriage, the language is one of acquisition. A man acquires a wife. The same word is man. The man acquires a piece of land. The man acquires some cattle. All right. This is similar in other traditions as well, but it's acquisition language or property language. A husband who disappears, and this was particularly difficult in times past when people would travel, selling things or whatever, they're on the road for whatever reason, whether it was war, whatever. A man or a husband who disappears, but there is no witness to his death, his wife is left what they called an agunah, a chained woman, a woman who is not permitted to remarry. So she is functionally a widow, even though there's no husband in sight, and not even the full function of a widow, because a woman who is a widow can remarry. But this agunah category, a lot of times they call them the women in limbo, all right? And so kind of an interesting sort of thing. Also, again, the purity laws that we talked a little bit about here, having to do with immersion and menstruation and that sort of thing that are incumbent upon women. There are some purity laws that are part of men's responsibilities as well, but they're not nearly as extensive as women's. All right. Again, partly because of menstruation and giving birth to children. All right. So there are all kinds of things that are part of that.
Were there any laws against property ownership for women?
Sometimes, and you see cases, sometimes women as part of their dowries were given property ownership. However, there were ways around that. A woman might own the property, but it had to be administered by her closest male relative.
How about it as an agunah?
Agunah, if she had a son, in that case, then he would do it, or closest male relative. Sometimes, though, you do read of women owning property and administering their own property, and partly because that went into the civil sphere, and if the civil government allowed them to own property, then they could do so. So that was a little bit trickier and place-dependent and time-dependent in terms of how they did that. But sometimes, and in some cultures, it was the closest male relative who would administer that property. But sometimes you do see instances of women doing this. Now, all of these things were part of traditional Jewish life. And it's hard to know whether they were always in place or not. All right? This is what we have from our textual tradition. Scholars today, among the many feminist scholars and female scholars, have been saying, wait a second, all this stuff is written down and certainly did happen to some extent, but does that mean it was always like this? And there are exceptions. You find Jewish communities in the early centuries of the Common Era where you do have women in public roles in the synagogue. Women, you have inscriptions that say, the leader, and with a woman's name, and other sorts of titles. When some of those inscriptions started to emerge, the assumption was that those were the wives of the male leader, the male reader, the male cantor. It was just the assumption. But now we've gone back, and scholars have said, wait a second. There are plenty of titles given to men. Why would they list them here, and often with no men connected to it? It just was a built-in assumption, one of those deep state. Well, obviously, they couldn't have had those roles, or texts don't suggest it, so they were the wives of those people. But looking back at some of those traditions, it is very possible that women could have participated in more of these activities than our texts suggest. We see some women, even in the rabbinic texts, some remarkable women, a woman named Beruria, the daughter of a rabbi, who was known for her wisdom in legal matters and could work. They said she could whip through an argument and see right through it and take it apart piece by piece faster than any man in her neighborhood. And so it was really a fascinating one, you know, and but she's not, you know, certainly a majority of women, but you see those bits and pieces here and there. All right. Now, when women look at all these sorts of things that are part of the tradition, especially in this past half a century, they've been questioning a lot of these sorts of things. Why do they need to be that way? Is this part of what it means to be Jewish? Or are there ways of transforming Judaism so that all people, men and women, are fully part of the community, full participants? And so you see a development and a pushing in all kinds of different directions. First of all, you know, starting kind of from the beginning of life, there are new rituals for welcoming baby girls into communities with different sorts of naming ceremonies, taking on covenants, and you see a whole bunch of different liturgies and rituals for that purpose. There's nothing standardized as of yet, but there are a number of different possibilities for that would kind of parallel the role of circumcision, all right? So even if you're looking this up and trying to find more about this in a library catalog, you can put Judaism, female, infant sort of things. You can try different sorts of, to try to find more about that, because I've seen a number of different possibilities where families and communities are trying to make a very, very direct effort to try to bring girls into that same sort of covenant with the rest of the Jewish community. Marriage agreements. Instead of using the language of acquisition, they are far more mutual. All right. What you often see in a Jewish household, a Jewish family, is something called a ketubah, which comes from the Hebrew word ketav, to write down. And this is where the obligations previously of the man were written, partly because it was an acquisition language. In the new ketubot, that's plural for ketubah, you see the obligations and responsibilities, what both parties are bringing to this marriage and what they mutually agree to do for and with each other.
Is so that true in very Orthodox?
No, not necessarily. And that is a good question, in that a lot of these sorts of things do not apply to Hasidic, Orthodox, or ultra-Orthodox Judaism. All right? So you kind of see, although some of them do, but you see really this kind of spectrum of Judaism for more traditional, and I prefer to use the word traditional as opposed to conservative, because conservative doesn't mean so much in that there's a group of conservative Jews, but traditional practices that maintain these sorts of legal categories. And then you have into a wider category of some modern Orthodox Jews, but not so many, conservative Jews, Reform Jews, Reconstructionist Jews, who are really experimenting with this. But the relationship between conservative, Reform, and Reconstructionist Jews to the law is far more tenuous. It's more of an option how much of it they will take on. So when you ask an Orthodox Jew or a Hasidic Jew, is a Reform person really a Jew doing all those things? Oh, no, absolutely not. You know, so there is certainly disagreement in the community. But I should mention that the majority of Jews in the United States self-identify as Reform Jews, all right? At least in leanings and religious affiliation. Even if they don't belong to a synagogue, they'll call themselves Reformed Jews. Reciprocal divorce agreements. It is no longer in some of these communities, and partly it has to do with living in a country like the United States, where divorces can be obtained by either party, all right? But some women have wanted the Jewish community to recognize their divorce at the same level and not consider them second class because of that. So within the Reformed tradition, conservative tradition, there is a recognition of divorce regardless of the side it comes from. So it is legitimate for a female to initiate the divorce, and her grounds are similar to those that we have culturally available to us. Right. Next, ordination of women. This is happening in some of these more like Reform, conservative, Reconstructionists, they ordain women. It is the Reform Jews started ordaining women in the early 1970s at about the same time that Lutherans started ordaining women. And the conservative Jewish movement started ordaining women in 1982. So now that you have female rabbis out there, if you take a look at the Reform seminaries in the United States, about half, and in some cases more than half of the students are women these days. Right? So that is changing the scene in synagogue life. That doesn't mean that female rabbis had it easy. It's very similar to the case. There are a lot of parallels between female pastors and female rabbis. The training was there, but that didn't mean that communities were always eager to hire them. All right, and it's taken longer to adjust and to become part of the synagogue scene. Another issue is with women becoming senior rabbis in large congregations. The same thing for females becoming senior pastors in large congregations. They are often put in associate roles. There's nothing wrong with being an associate if men and women share that role equally, but if you see most senior pastors as men or senior rabbis and associates as women, that's still a major issue that Christians are looking at with ordained women and that Jews are contending with as well. But that is part of, and interestingly, in Jewish law, there really isn't anything against the ordination of women, per se. It is more of a traditional practice. And so even rabbis who are confronted with that question legally aren't always able to come up with really solid arguments, even less so than in other cases. They'll say, well, it's just not Jewish to ordain women. And a lot of those arguments were there for Christians as well. Why shouldn't women be pastors? Well, it's just not Christian. Whatever that means. Or it's just not Lutheran. It's just not Methodist. Kind of resorting to that sort of bottom line type of argument. Reading from Torah in the synagogue is now very common practice in Reform and conservative Reconstructionist communities. So you'll have women going up to the bima is the area in the front upon which the Torah reading platform is, and the ark containing the scrolls is usually behind. So you have women coming up, reading in Hebrew, doing the sorts of things that men traditionally did. And young women are trained just as young men are in these situations, because women in some of these traditions now do a bat mitzvah, daughter of the commandment ceremony, which is actually identical to the male ceremony. And so that they're taking on the full obligations of membership in that community, just as their male counterparts would be. All right, all the things that go along with that. No separation in the conservative and Reform communities. So you walk into a Reform synagogue on a Friday evening or a Saturday morning, and you will not find a division between sexes. Everybody will sit, families, whatever, similar to what we'd see in a typical church setting.
Thank you.
Yes.
Catch the bus.
All right. Study. Study is urged on women. You have a whole new generation of female Jewish scholars that has been emerging and teaching in seminaries and in colleges. It's really kind of an exciting development. Women who study Talmud, women who study law, women who study Jewish history, women who study theology, all these different aspects. And they're adding their voices to these traditions and participating in these discussions. It's also kind of a strange world where you have non-Jewish a non-Jewish presence in these texts commenting on them, so that you'd have a Christian Lutheran female messing around in these texts and adding two cents here and there and adding to that discussion. So it's kind of interesting, and Christian men and a lot more, you know, wider participation. Women can be part of a minyan, where minyans are held. Again, in not the Orthodox and more traditional, but in some of the more liberal traditions. So if there are, again, the 10 people and 3 or 6 of them are women, fine, let's hold a minyan. No problem, it counts. All right. God language. And this has a lot of parallels with Christianity in terms of looking at more expansive use of God language. How do we refer to God? How do we think of ourselves in relation to relationship to God? How do we think of God as being? Is it primarily male, or are there other female characteristics that we can add, or more even neutral sorts of things, ways that we can think of God? And this area, I'm not going to talk a lot about it, partly because I think there are so many things that the Jewish and Christian communities have in common there. And they've done a lot of sharing, in fact, in terms of how to look at God language and the idea of God in general in a different way. You've got women, and this is kind of interesting. There's a woman named Haviva Ner David, who is a modern Orthodox woman studying for ordination in Jerusalem. All right, there are modern Orthodox feminists, all right? She has yet to be ordained. She's done all the stuff, but from her reading of the text, and as I said, there aren't very good arguments against female ordination, she is hoping to be ordained. And her take on this is that she has decided to take on all the commandments, the positive, the, you know, all those sorts of things, even the time-bound ones. She's a mother of 3 children, so she and her husband have been trying to figure this sort of thing out. But she has seen, in order to elevate her status in the community and to see herself as a full member, she says, I can take this stuff on, I can study, I can do these sorts of things. So she's found some rabbis willing to work with her, but it's still, and there are others like her, but she's done a lot of writing about this journey and trying to get there to see how, what it would take, what it would look like. I don't know, when I talk to people, how soon it would be, if ever, that the Orthodox community will ordain women. It's hard to say. Some circles you may see more of that. Transformed rituals. This is a huge area, especially when you take a look at literature written by women and for women. Things like the Passover Seder have been, and there are whole new ways of looking at some of these festivals and rituals. There has been going on since, I think, 1974, something called the Women's Passover Community, where only women get together to do the Passover. Because traditionally, it said that everyone should be free on the Passover. And they identify who those free people should be, and women are never part of the list. So it's like, you know, your slaves and your animals and your children and no women.
They fall on the slaves.
No, the slaves even got, you know, that's the thing, the slaves even got freedom on Passover and some of those holidays, but women were too busy getting the food ready. And I think that's another area where women throughout the world and in throughout cultures can connect on something like that. And does that mean that women are saying, do away with the food? No, they're saying, you know, we got to split up these responsibilities and make them all sacred so that men will help with food and women will do, you know, a more a blending approach. But for a while, they tried women's only Passovers, some women in groups, just to kind of feel how it might be to be free and full members of the community. A Passover of freedom for them, not just for others. All right? All kinds of different things. Like I mentioned, the bat mitzvah, the naming rituals, wedding ceremonies, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, Rosh Hashanah, the New Year, Purim, Hanukkah, all these different possibilities are there. Shavuot, where rituals are being transformed for women to participate more fully in each of those sorts of things. And I should certainly mention the Sabbath, because that would be the key place. If you remember, I said that was one of their only time-bound positive commandments, that they're obligated, lighting the Sabbath candles. So the mother of the household would light those candles. And after that, the responsibilities would transfer to the father of the household, or the male head of the household. And now some of those responsibilities are being shifted and shared among family members, right, in some households. I think one of the biggest efforts, these are more practical, but more theoretical, something that I would be more involved in myself, is looking at history in a new way. Re-examining history, law, and memory, and trying to figure out and reclaim what women's roles were. The text that we have, from the biblical text to the Mishnah to the Talmud to the Midrash, a lot of this body of text, they were written by men for a male audience. All right? So they weren't part of the women's world or experience. Women's experiences were not even considered essential to this stuff. So as women today, as Jewish feminists looking back at this, they're saying, okay, we need to read between the lines. We need to be a little bit more critical. We need to ask questions. Is this really the way it was? Okay, so maybe, and sometimes they find, no, it wasn't. Sometimes they find, yes, it was that way, but should it continue to be this way? Do we need to make some changes? Do we need to get rid of some things entirely? Now, questions like that are bound to do what to a community? Anytime you think about messing with tradition, people get anxious. People get very anxious. But these are important questions, because women are saying, are we too not Jews? Are we too not part of the covenant? Were we not also standing at Sinai? Right? When God, and through Moses, gave the commandments and passed the law down. And they're trying to figure out how they can be fully part of the community they were born into and have taken upon themselves. All right. So those are some of the sorts of things that are going on today. And we've got a little time for questions, and I'd like to open it up just to see what sorts of things you're particularly interested in. In terms of any of these legal sorts of things?
Uh-huh. I don't know much at all about the Jewish, but the men always wear the little hats, and do women have to wear anything, and do the men still wear those?
Yes, men do, especially upon entering the synagogue. Traditionally, in traditional societies, like Orthodox, Hasidic, and ultra-Orthodox, women, married women, will cover their heads. But it's generally with a wig. What their obligation is to cover their hair so that their glory is only available to their husbands. Some of the very most traditional women will shave their heads and wear wigs. And I still can't figure out how that would be great for a husband. I just can't. So I can understand the wig thing. I can understand the head covering, but the bald head underneath, it just doesn't make any rational sense. So I've still got to be thinking about that. I don't know any ultra-Orthodox women well enough to say, so, like, why? How does that, like, work? Because I know some the legal stuff. I just want to know how it works. But yes, so women in more traditional settings will either wear wigs or a head covering. I think they're called, like, snoods, where it would cover up to the top of your head and cover the bulk of your hair, so you'd see, you know there's hair there, but you can't see it. So, like, when I'm in Walmart in Decorah, Iowa, we have a large Hasidic community near us, I told my students in my Judaism class, I said, would you go to Walmart? Just look. Go down the aisle. You can take it. If you get close enough to that hair, you can see it's a wig. And so you can kind of see that. You can pretty much tell. On the bus in Jerusalem, I couldn't figure out, first of all, how these women had such pristine, perfect hair. And I'm like, oh.
Now, did the women work at Walmart or shop there?
They're shopping there.
Oh.
But the women, some of them would have jobs as well. But yes, in Decorah, you have all these diverse communities shopping there. But men, and today in the Reform community, it's very interesting, because if you walk into a Reform synagogue, you will find a little bit of everything. You'll find men they're called a couple of different things. Skull caps, kippah, which is a head covering, or yarmulke, which is the Yiddish word for head
covering. And they're usually just little round hats, but it doesn't necessarily have to be like that. And you'll find men and women doing that equally, because I have friends that are female rabbis or female Jews in the Reformed tradition, and they'll wear them.
Is the Hasidic form of Judaism growing?
In some areas, partly just through reproduction.
Oh, yeah.
They have big families.
Yeah.
But also, I should note, the Hasidic Jews are very active in proselytizing other Jews. They have what you call Chabad houses, especially near college campuses and in places in New York City, in Jerusalem, where they will reach out to what they feel are secular Jews. Secular Jews, anybody who's pretty much not Hasidic, Reform, conservative included, and invite them in to Sabbath and show them what a Hasidic life is like, you know, kind of embrace them with the family. And so, yes, you do see some converts into Hasidic Judaism, but they're, in terms of conversion and proselytism, they're more active than any other Jewish grouping.
Well, coming back to the reproduction, do they not believe in birth control?
From what I can see in the Hasidic and more traditional communities, no. And believe might be a little harder word, but I don't know that they practice that, because I've seen families from, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13 children. I was on a plane to Tel Aviv once, and I saw this father across the aisle from me, you know, praying the whole time. And his wife had 8 children that she was caring for on that 11-hour flight. So I was ready to go and say, excuse me.
Not that that would have
made any difference, but, you know, I just couldn't imagine. But among the Reform Jews and others, yes, it's just the same as in the rest of society. In smaller families are really the rule, and birth control is not an issue. Even abortion is not considered necessarily an issue in a lot of those communities.
A good buddy of mine is a midwife, and she was telling me that she's cared for Hasidic women.
Uh-huh.
And extremely Orthodox women, and the whole monthly cycle thing. You go to the mikvah a week, like, she's sexually available. They can get back together right at the time when she's most fertile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly the timing. Yeah, it's very much
so
designed.
The timing is really
critical.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's exactly timed so that she is, again, available to her husband for, I think, 2 weeks of every month, mm-hmm. and usually the most fertile time. So it's kind of interesting. So you see really often larger families in those settings. Yeah. Kind of interesting. Other sorts of questions?
Last Sunday, I just went to a wedding. Our pastor, who is ELCA, mm-hmm. and a cantor married a gal from our church who obviously is Lutheran. And he supposedly was Jewish, and they had that as part of the, they had a mixed service just because to please his grandparents. Mm. You know, so it was real interesting. They broke about, they were under the, I know nothing about it, under this.
The kupa.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then that was about it. And then the cantor said a lot of things that our Lutheran pastor more or less repeated. They worked real well together. And then they did break the glass,
right.
And he stomped on it. But otherwise, it was pretty much a Lutheran ceremony.
You know, what? And that was probably Reform Jewish mixed marriages in that sense, or marrying someone who's not Jewish is a real issue in the Reform and conservative communities today, because more than half of all Jews, and I've heard upwards of 60, even 70%, are marrying outside the Jewish community in the Reform tradition. And a lot of the rabbis and leadership in the movement are really concerned, because what they're finding is that a Jew who marries outside of Judaism will be far less likely to raise their children Jewish. And especially in the United States. So it's you see a lot of, it's actually not called mixed marriage, it's called intermarriage. You find a lot of discussion of that in current Jewish magazines and books and that sort of thing. It's an ongoing issue in terms of, and some congregations, there are some innovative ones in Chicago on the south side, it's KM Isaiah, I believe, are taking a new tactic, and they represent a new trend on that, to try to welcome mixed faith families to worship so that children are exposed to Judaism and whatever other faith tradition that they're part of. So they're trying to reach out and do ministry with in intermarried families. And that seems to be a new and fairly effective trend. And so you see a lot of discussion about how to do that and do it well. Yep.
Is there any attempt for ecumenism in Jewish congregations? I've read a few things in the Christian tradition where they are actually saying we separated too much from Jewish tradition. Mm-hmm. And Spong's book, I didn't understand a lot of that, but he tied almost all of the rituals that we have with what had been rituals in the Jewish tradition, mm-hmm. and that they just adapted them because they were changing, it was changing to a new religion.
Well, I think you're right there. You do have, especially within, again, the Reform, Reconstructionist, Conservative groups, a lot of efforts towards ecumenical dialogue. The Lutherans have an ongoing dialogue with the Reform Jews, ELCA Lutherans and Reform Jews. And you see a lot of efforts. You see coordinated efforts in Bloomington, Indiana. You have a Lutheran church side by side with a Jewish synagogue, and they share a lot of facilities. And they do a lot of dialogue. They even do some adults Sunday school together. So you do see things like that are going on mm-hmm. as well. And you see a lot of that. And you also see a Jewish, I'll conclude on this note, a Jewish, in some circles, reclaiming of Jesus. In that not yes. believing in Jesus as Messiah, but recognizing, saying, this is a Jewish figure. This is part of our tradition. We need to learn about them. So a lot of Jewish seminaries, and I know two scholars in particular, who are Jewish New Testament scholars, and very fine ones. One of them is at Vanderbilt, and her name is Amy Jill Levine, and you can take a look at her stuff. Another one is Michael Cook, and he's at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. There are others, but those are two noted Jewish New Testament scholars, and that go out and talk to the Christian and Jewish communities about the role of Jesus in the New Testament and how it forms part of the Jewish tradition.
That's nice.
Yeah. So, well, thank you so much. If you have other questions.